Good evening and welcome to Lehigh Valley Arts Salon on WDIY Community Public Radio. I'm Bill Altramont-Smith, your host this evening, and tonight we will be talking about Mali and books about Mali and a blog about the current situation in Mali with our guest Bruce Whitehouse. Bruce is a teacher at Lehigh University of Anthropology and Global Studies, and he is the author of a book that came out last year and the author of a regular blog, Bridges from Bamako. Bruce, welcome to WDIY, Lehigh Valley Arts Salon.
Thanks, Bill. It's great to be here.
My pleasure having you down here. And Bruce was actually down here at the DIY studios only a month or so ago as a guest on NPR's All Things Considered, broadcast here on WDIY as an expert on what's happening in Mali right now based on his blogging of the situation. But Bruce, tell us a bit about your background and your involvement in Mali and how you came to write both the book and to be doing the current blog.
Sure. I started out, it was about 16 years ago, as a Peace Corps volunteer in Mali, and I was there for 3 years. And it was during that experience, living mostly in a rural community in the southern part of the country, that I sort of felt this calling to spend more time in the country. I didn't want to go home when my service was up. I wanted to learn more, and I wanted to find some way to apply what I was learning as a Peace Corps volunteer about the people that I was living among and the society, the history. So after my Peace Corps service ended in 2000, I looked around for graduate programs, and I settled on a program in anthropology at Brown University, and I worked on my doctorate there. And I continued going back to Mali every couple of years to do field research. And I was there most recently from August of 2011 through June of 2012 as a Fulbright scholar in the capital city in Bamako. And that's where I began the blog, Bridges from Bamako, that we're going to be talking about.
You also have family in Mali, right?
Yeah, Umu comes from the Ségou region in the center of Mali, but she has many relatives in Bamako and in other parts of the country.
You have sources to the ground directly in Mali, both family and lots of other sources of a network of people that you've made contact with over the last 16 years.
That's right, and she and I are in regular touch with our friends and family back there.
Let's talk about your recent book, Migrants and Strangers in an African City, that was published last year by
Indiana University Press.
Okay. It received some interesting acclaim, and one of the notes was one of the best overlooked books of 2012. So we're trying to rectify that here. And Bruce, so tell us a bit about the origin of the book and what the book covers.
Okay, well, the book grew out of my first anthropological field work, which I began in 2002, shortly after starting my graduate studies. And I went to Mali to study a community which is about 100 miles north of the capital city, very dry, destitute part of the country, and it's really known for producing a large number of emigrants, people who leave Mali and go abroad. And I wanted to study what large-scale emigration does to the social fabric of a community. And I found that it was actually a very vibrant community, but that it was not spatially contained within the bounds of this village. It was a translocal community that included a lot of people in the capital city. It included a lot of people living abroad. And that most of those people who went abroad actually didn't go to places like France or the United States or Canada. Most of them went to other African countries. And I found that the most common destination abroad was Côte d'Ivoire, which is Mali's neighbor to the south, so no surprise there. But the second most common destination for migrants from this town was a country called Congo-Brazzaville, also known as the Republic of Congo in Central Africa. It's 2,000 miles by air from Mali. So I was intrigued by why migrants were traveling this great distance to go to another African country that was roughly as poor as their place of origin and actually less stable and less secure. So that was really the genesis, that initial field work in this migrant sending community that paved the way for later field work that I did in the city of Brazzaville, where several thousand of these migrants live and work. So my doctoral field work involved spending about a year in Brazzaville, living among the West African migrants there, most of them coming from Mali. And I wrote the book out of that experience.
One thing which you'd mentioned to me made it even more surprising that Malians were migrating to Brazzaville was a study done in the early 2000s of 400 cities around the world in terms of the livability of the cities, and Brazzaville rated absolutely rank last amongst those 400. And yet there we have people migrating to Brazzaville.
That's right. So there was an interesting contradiction that I wanted to explore. It was actually in the winter of 2003 that ranking came out, and the BBC wrote a story about it on their website with the headline, Brazzaville, World's Worst City. And at this point, I had recently come back from Mali, and I knew that there were a good number of migrants going there. So I thought, well, this is an interesting irony that I ought to explore further.
Interesting also that you make us aware that there's actually more migration between African countries than there is of Africans migrating to Europe or North America, whereas I think most people here would tend to think most African migration is out of Africa and not across large distances within Africa. Clearly, there is between countries, particularly when certain ethnic groups, the national boundaries are not the ethnic boundaries. You expect migration amongst adjacent countries, but 2,000 miles to a country that also was not a French colony, it was a Belgian colony, I think.
No, the Republic of Congo was the former French Congo, which is why there's two Congos in Central Africa. The Belgian Congo became Congo-Kinshasa. The French Congo became Congo-Brazzaville.
Okay, thank you. I always get confused, and I managed to get confused again there. The Malians make up quite a significant fraction of the population in Brazzaville, you tell us about.
Well, it's hard to know how many of them there are, for one thing. Estimates range from maybe 20 to 30,000 in the city of Brazzaville itself, and that's out of a population of less than a million, maybe 800,000 or 900,000. So it's not a huge minority group in that context, but they punch above their weight in terms of their economic role. The Malians and other West African migrants really dominate the marketplace. They're the shopkeepers, they're the traders. They're the importers and the exporters. They play a really vital role in commerce in Congo and really throughout the Central African region. So they're a highly visible minority that's probably more important than their overall numbers would suggest.
Okay. Take us back a bit. I think you mentioned in the book how it came to be that Brazzaville was a location that Malians were emigrating to, and it goes back, a couple of centuries?
Well, it goes back more than a century, and there's a fascinating story about the very first representative of the French Republic to occupy what's today called Brazzaville, and this was a Senegalese sergeant who was a member of France's colonial infantry. He had served the French on the Senegalese coast for a few years, and he signed up for an expedition to explore the Central African interior under the command of a French officer named Savarnyan de Brazza. This is the man for whom the city of Brazzaville was later named. And Savarnyan de Brazza actually recruited a large number of these West African troops in Senegal to make up the bulk of his force going into the Congolese forests. Really, without the West African manpower on those expeditions, I don't think that the French could have pulled it off. So from the very beginning of French contact with equatorial Africa, they were highly dependent on West African manpower, on West African troops. And then once these soldiers who served two-year contracts, once their time was done in Central Africa, in many cases they stayed on. They went into commerce, they started up some kind of trading post, and then they would bring their relatives over. So what began as a sort of colonial auxiliary presence for these Senegalese and Malians and other West Africans in Congo very quickly morphed into a commercial network that really was there for its own purposes.
Interesting story. You've mentioned that the Malians tend to be referred to as strangers, and that even though they've been there for well over a century, there is quite a separation between the Malian immigrants and the Congolese native population. Tell us a bit more about what you observed there.
The term stranger is one that I use. In French, there's no distinguishing between a foreigner and a stranger. The same noun, l'étranger, refers to both. But I use the term stranger in English to refer to a group of people, many of whom are foreign-born, but some of them are actually born in Congo, but because they all have foreign ancestry and practice certain ways identified as alien within the Congolese context, none of them can be considered natives or full-fledged members of Congolese society, even those who were born and raised there and have never lived anywhere else. So I use this category as a kind of catch-all for these people of West African descent, some of whom are sort of fresh off the boat or fresh off the airplane, some of whom have been there literally for generations, for two, three, four generations. But they all occupy this very distinct position within Congolese society where they're, even after generations, they're not assimilated. They maintain their old country ways, their language. They practice Islam, which is not the religion of the Congolese majority. And they stand out in very many ways. And there's a number of reasons for that. Part of it has to do with discrimination from the Congolese, but part of it has to do with the interests of these strangers in sort of maintaining a distinct identity and some of the economic benefits that go along with that.
Interesting. There's a lot of parallels between various immigrant groups into the U.S., of Asian groups I'm thinking of in particular, Indian groups, as well as African groups, or for that matter, Middle Eastern groups, Israelis, etc. A lot of parallels of what you actually see over here, and you don't necessarily think of that happening between one African country and another.
Well, there's a structural dynamic where migrants very often occupy a particular role within the economy of the host country. So what I was observing in Brazzaville with these Malians being the shopkeepers and the import exporters, it wasn't unusual at all. If you look at a lot of societies around the world, you see that immigrants play that role and have certain advantages economically that the locals don't enjoy.
Bruce, we've touched the surface on this very interesting cultural and sociological study of immigration within Africa, immigration into the Congo from Mali. Tell us again where the book can be obtained.
Well, the book's available online through Amazon.com, or you can go to the Indiana University Press website, which is iupress.indiana.edu, and order it there.
Okay. And the book is available in paperback and hardback, I believe, right?
Yes.
All right. This is Lehigh Valley Arts Salon. I'm Bill Orchmore-Smith, your host this evening, and we are talking with Bruce Whitehouse, who teaches both anthropology and global studies at Lehigh University. We've been talking about his book, and we will be back after the break to talk about his blog, Bridges from Bamako.
WDIY is pleased to partner with the Zollner Arts Center, presenting the Lehigh University Jazz Program's Spring Concert, Saturday, April 13th at 8 p.m. This annual spring concert features contemporary and traditional jazz performed by the ensemble, band, combo, and funk groups under the direction of Bill Warfield. For information, 610-758-2787 or zollnerartscenter.org.
Welcome back to Lehigh Valley Arts Salon. I'm Bill Watermull-Smith, your host this evening, talking with Bruce Whitehouse, who teaches both anthropology and global studies at Lehigh University. We've been talking to him about his book, and in this final section, we will be talking to him about his blog, which has been attracting a lot of attention, Bridges from Bamako. So, Bruce, you told us about your background in Mali, but tell us a bit more how you originated the blog.
Well, I went there in August of 2011 to Bamako to begin 10 months as a Fulbright scholar, which meant I was going to do some teaching at the university in Bamako and do some of my own research, which is on marriage and polygamy in urban Mali. So I began this stay in the summer and fall of 2011, and I wanted to have a way to keep my friends and colleagues and family members at home abreast of what I was doing and share some of the initial impressions that I was getting from my research and just observations of life in the city. The tagline for the blog is Life in a Budding West African Metropolis. Bamako is a city of 2 million people, one of the fastest growing cities in the world, certainly on the African continent. So it's a very dynamic place. So I began the blog as a way of sharing certain slices of life in Bamako. I wrote about what it's like to set up a household when you're moving there from out of the country. I wrote about going to the National Park downtown, which is a new green space that the Malian government created. I wrote about Malian reactions to the fall of Muammar Gaddafi in Libya and his death in October of 2011. Gaddafi was a very popular figure in Mali and in much of Africa, so I was trying to explain his image, which is so divergent in Mali from the way that he was perceived in the United States.
I understand he was a major benefactor in Mali.
Gaddafi underwrote all kinds of infrastructure projects, government buildings, mosques. He helped finance the state television broadcasting service in the 1980s. So he had a very long-standing relationship with successive Malian governments.
And this then led to Malians going to help support the Gaddafi regime in Libya, right?
There were many Tuareg, this is a nomadic ethnic group from the north of Mali, who were already integrated into the Libyan armed forces as early as the 1970s. Gaddafi essentially recruited them because their homeland was hit by a drought. So thousands of these Tuareg migrated to Libya, and many of them were recruited into the Libyan army. When his fall from power was underway, he started recruiting more foreign fighters in Mali and elsewhere. So many of them, but not all of them, were Tuareg from the north of Mali. And these Malian and other African fighters were left in Libya after Gaddafi's death in a very difficult spot.
And had access to a lot of armaments that they had been provided with in Libya. Right?
Indeed. And so when these fighters, particularly the Tuareg, returned to Mali at the end of 2011, they brought those weapons with them, and they were able to reinvigorate what had been a kind of stalled ethnic separatist rebellion in the north of Mali, to the point that it actually succeeded in taking over about 60% of Mali's territory the early months of 2012.
And this ended up being a sort of loose coalition between the returning Tuareg as well as the extreme Islamist group active in North Africa as well, right?
Absolutely. So there was a marriage of convenience, if you will, between the Tuareg nationalist separatist group, which is called the MNLA, and some Islamist groups that were already operating in this sort of lawless area of the Sahara between Algeria, Mali, Niger, Mauritania. You have Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, you have an offshoot group called the Movement for Oneness and Jihad in West Africa, and then you had a kind of homegrown Islamist group in the north of Mali called Ansar al-Din, which is dominated by Tuareg members, whereas the other Islamist groups are mostly non-Malians. So all these groups came together in the end of 2011, early 2012, and succeeded in driving out the Malian armed forces from the northernmost regions of the country.
And I understand that coalition has basically totally fallen apart right now.
Even in the summer of 2012, it had already collapsed, and the Islamists essentially ejected the secular separatists from their coalition and had complete control of this area of northern Mali about the size of Texas. And this is where we heard about all the human rights abuses and Sharia-inspired punishments, stonings and whippings and amputations of hands and feet, that kind of thing. So there was a terrible human drama that was playing out in Mali throughout the last year.
And your blog in particular, covering that, gained a lot of attention when you were covering the French invasion to help drive back as the rebel groups began to push down into the south towards Bamako. I understand the Malian government invited the ex-colonial power France to come in and actually help defend and push back the rebels. And you did a lot of reporting and analyzing of that situation, which gained a lot of national coverage and international coverage.
I'll call it analysis because I was not in Mali at the time that the French went in. I left Mali with my family in June of 2012, but I kept the blog going sort of intermittently up until the beginning of this year, when the French intervened militarily and the world's attention turned back to events in Mali. So I've been trying to share my own experience and views of what's happening in Mali through the blog, and that channel has brought me exposure to various national and international media. It's gotten me noticed by other scholars in universities. I'm giving talks at universities around the country about the situation in Mali. So from my perspective as a scholar, the blog has been a very good thing for me.
So it's really, in addition to your regular university teaching, you now have on a significant load of writing the blog each week. I know last week's issue of your blog, you had very nice analysis of all the different ethnic groups in Mali, and that the Tuareg are really not one particular group on their own either. So I would encourage our listeners, if you're interested in this topic, there's some really nice analysis and insight from Bruce on the blog, Bridges from Bamako. Bruce, just to close out, we have about 30 seconds or so. To access the blog, how do people get to it?
Well, it's bridgesfrombamako.com, and you can find links to all the previous posts going back to the period before Mali's coup in March of last year. But most of the blogging that I've done has been subsequent to the coup, and it explains the political and social context behind events going on in Mali.
Well, if you're interested in what's happening in West Africa, I highly recommend you checking out Bruce's blog, Bridges from Bamako. Thank you, Bruce, for joining us this evening on Lehigh Valley Arts Salon.
Thank you, Bill. It's been my pleasure.
Faso ba ti ke tomboye ala kayira jamala.